the challenge of reading my handwritten notes is one that sometimes confounding. All right.
Since the dawn of 2009, one TV show has dared to ask the most important questions about the origins of our world. That show is Ancient Aliens.
Yet until now, no one has asked the biggest question of all. Is Ancient Aliens total bullshit?
And that's what our show's about. Finding the truth under the nonsense of one of television's most popular franchises.
This is...
more like Ancient Phalians.
That's good.
That's good.
It's better than me.
This is More Like Ancient Phalians, a podcast about the History Channel show Ancient Aliens. I'm Brandon R. Reynolds, a journalist who covers all kinds of things, but for the sake of argument today, let's say I cover the Civil War.
And I'm Toby Ball, the creator and host of the UFO podcast Strange Arrivals. And our guest today is Blake Smith, one of the two hosts of Monster Talk. Blake, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hopefully people have already listened to Monster Talk, but if you were like interested enough to check out this podcast, Monster Talk is completely up your alley. And I've been on a couple times. You should definitely check it out.
Thanks. Yeah, we call ourselves the science show about monsters, and we're monsters and monster adjacent. So it's not just monsters, but you know, anything from Bigfoot to the Wolfman to Jeff the Talking Mongoose. That's us. So,
and today, the monster adjacent thing we're going to be talking about is the Civil War. The episode we're doing of Ancient Aliens is from Season 9, Episode 9, Aliens and the Civil War. Interestingly, when I was looking for this episode, I also found it listed as Season 7, Episode 9. So it depends somehow on where you look, which I guess is maybe a function of the aliens moving back and forward in time, manipulating our reality. I don't know why that is, though. I don't have any idea why it's inconsistent.
Could it be because aliens?
Yes. Yeah. So. Ancient astronaut theorists posit
aliens.
Aliens.
This episode is a little different than a lot of the ones that are in Ancient Aliens, and particularly ones that we've covered, which, you know, usually all roads lead to the Egyptian pyramids or, you know, a Sumerian hieroglyph or something. But in this case, it's fairly recent history, and it's in, for some of us, Blake, for example, it's in our literal backyards, the Civil War. And so that's kind of unusual, and the episode itself seems to almost restrain itself. I say almost restrain itself. If you squint or if you're just walking in and out of the room while the episode's on, it will sort of seem like a sane version of a History Channel show about the Civil War.
It's like the History Channel 2005,
yes. Yeah.
You know, when it, yeah. Yeah. Civil War and World War II, you know, yeah.
And while that's refreshing, it doesn't take long for them to blow up that whole spot with lines like, might there have even been more at stake than we know regarding the Civil War? Could it be that the preservation of the Union was ensured by extraterrestrial beings? So even the Civil War, we can't seem to just fight amongst ourselves. It has to be the aliens getting in there, interfering.
Well, they wanted to preserve the Union, clearly.
They had an opinion.
It's a big galactic issue.
It is interesting to imagine. I mean, when you had people who lived here and couldn't figure out what was going on or which side to take, but Ancient Aliens, what are they? I mean, they're aliens. Are there perhaps they're ghosts or perhaps they're angels? In this episode, there are lots of different things. But I mean, in the end, obviously aliens. But what does that even mean? I'm a little unclear on that. But yeah. It's just a wonder that they could be cruising by and it takes such interest in our affairs, especially here in the United States. Which is also the country that produces this show. There may be some coincidence there.
Fascinating. Well, I like that any good discussion of the Civil War, of course, begins with Mormons, specifically with Joseph Smith. The year is 1831, Jackson County, Missouri. It's 30 years before the Civil War, and you have a man who has a dream about the future in which there's going to be a great war of some kind, probably, delivered to him by what the religion calls the angel Moroni. But, Blake, as you said, you never know what you're really dealing with when you're dealing with an angel or a ghost or any of these things. Anything that's glowing, we should assume, it could be an alien. And in this case, that is the thesis that the ancient alien theorists are taking. Why not assume that what we thought was an angel giving him prophecies about the future and telling him where the gold tablets are that ended up becoming the Book of Mormon?
Is it possible that the angel Moroni, this perhaps extraterrestrial being, was very concerned about the Civil War, and that's why it gave Joseph Smith an advanced prophetic glimpse into what was coming? Was this another one of the efforts to intervene and to try to steer our history towards the most favorable outcome? Perhaps not just for us, but also for the extraterrestrials themselves.
Maybe that wasn't an angel. Maybe it was a being from another world trying to warn us about this war that's coming down the pike.
I had some positive thoughts about this, which is hard for me to say with a straight face, but I'm not joking. Because I think there's a tendency among people who are critical of this very serious show to say that the show is inherently racist, because they're always saying that, you know, people from this culture couldn't build that monolith, they couldn't build that pyramid, or they couldn't build that temple, and so on. And it's like they're taking these people's, you know, sincere mythological beliefs or religious beliefs or whatever, and then they're saying, no, but actually it was aliens. And they never say, you know, that Stonehenge was incapable of being built by, you know, the locals. But here, they take on the Mormons immediately. They're like, no, I mean, sure, he said it was an angel, but we know it was really an alien. And I'm like, okay. So they're an equal opportunity cultural appropriators or stompers or whatever you want to call it. You don't have to be brown skinned and from a country where they don't speak English. You could be right here in the good old US of A and it still was aliens. Yeah. That's very magnanimous.
Yeah, there is still a little bit of the inherent racism, because the reasoning seems to be still a little bit like the Egyptians aren't going to do this by themselves. They have to have it. But it's important for America. It's important for the universe that these aliens make sure America does it right, because somehow cosmic democracy hangs in the balance.
They sure let slavery linger a long time before they decided to intervene, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, you know, again, they had the ability to predict a war 30 years down the road, and they didn't seem like they were doing enough to stop it. So obviously it's a
light hand. Mm-hmm. The wheel of history requires a light hand.
And, you know, along those lines, they, if you think that Joseph Smith is not enough of a sacred cow, so to speak, they pivot right to Valley Forge, George Washington, having a quote similar vision by which he saw some fuzzy thing that told him about a war.
I had a question about this, and I did some research on some other stuff, but is that contemporaneous, or is that feels like something that somebody made up later and sort of reverse engineered that? And then the ancient alien guys were like, okay, it's just not even enough. Like, we'll just make it an alien. Do you know if what the story is? Does anybody know what the story is behind this? I wish I'd looked.
Yeah, I found a really cool blog, a history blog called Boston 1775, and the author there is J.L. Bell, and he did a pretty deep dive. It's really good. I don't know if you guys want to put that in the show notes or whatever, but he found that this was written by a sort of a dramatic potboiler type author. Let me be blunt, kind of cashing in on the situation at the start of the American Civil War. And so he writes this very patriotic story about George Washington and the fate of our nation. And in a time when a lot of these kinds of pamphlets / novellas are being written. And it looks very lurid. He wrote it under a pen name. But it appears to have been pulled from his own orifices, not from any historical sourcing.
Yeah. So we'll see more of that later on when Ambrose Bierce comes into the picture.
That quality, I hope, not more of other people's orifices, right?
No, Toby and I talked about it, and I believe that our show is going to be a very limited orifice show.
Yeah.
Good deal. Good deal.
Not exclusively none, but certainly fewer than some other shows.
We could just try.
So, yeah, this episode jumps around a little bit to, you know, again, it feels like they're sort of setting in motion the conditions for the Civil War. Like, you know, there's this conflict here, this conflict there, you know, here's a skirmish, here's this. Instead of these skirmishes, though, it's like in Wilmington, Delaware in 1860, 200-foot-long glowing object that Nick Pope says, certainly nobody should have been flying a rocket in 1860. Thank you, Nick.
They actually downplay this one a little bit. At least that was my memory. I took a look at this, and it was reported in the Wilmington Tribune edition of July 30th, 1860. And they said that the entire town was bathed in a blue light, a pale blue light. But the whole thing only lasted about a minute. And I can't remember if they mentioned this in the show, but there were three balls following this 200-foot long thing. And then a fourth one joined them that was giving off sparkles.
That is called a shooting star, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
That is exactly what that looks like. Or if you live in Los Angeles like I do, it is one of Elon Musk's SpaceX rockets.
Oh, yeah.
Launched.
They drop a lot of stories in here.
Yeah.
It is said, or, you know, history records.
Right.
A little light on the bibliography on some of this stuff.
Well, something that I noticed is one of the rhetorical devices for the show is for the narrator to posit the, you know, the absurd thing that either reiterates the thesis of the episode or sets up the next section. And it's like, you know, did aliens come down to influence the course of the Civil War for the sake of future Americans? And then the quote is always, ancient astronaut theorists say yes.
Ancient astronaut theorists say yes.
Yes.
And in this case, I counted the number of times in the episode that ancient astronaut theorists say yes. And the count for this episode, 6 times, they say.
Oh.
That's funny. I did the count on is it possible and could it be? 7 is it possibles and 4 could it be?
There's a lot.
Wow. So we're up to like 19 different phrases in 42 minutes.
Yeah, be careful with your drinking games because you could die.
Oh,
yeah.
For sure.
It's a compact show.
Narrator Robert Clotworthy gets a lot of mileage out of the rhetorical question.
He only had to say it once and they just inserted in over and over again.
I do think so. I do think that's it. I did listen to a couple of different versions of it and I was like, I think it's the same recording. I really do. It's wild. So we kick around a few different locations in the time before the war where people are seeing stuff ostensibly in the sky. It's showing up in newspapers. You have New York, then Fort Sumter, where it's established that people thought the war was going to be won and done with picnic baskets and champagne just to watch the battle, the one big battle. And then the quote that I continue to sort of be boggled by, which is the quote about the Civil War, more American lives lost than every other war combined, which you say, well, that's a lot, but also everybody who died was American. So you're automatically doubling the...
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So
it's a lot going on because, I mean, there are also big technological changes that had happened right before this war. So the rifles had improved and you're seeing like the ironclads, you're seeing the first sort of machine gun type devices and... It was just a different kind of war. We'd never seen this before. Medicine certainly wasn't able to keep up with it. There was no kind of decent armor. It's an impressive war in so many ways. And I just hadn't realized up until watching this how much of that was because of aliens.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, they really didn't cover that in my high school.
Or Ken Burns, to be honest. It wasn't there. I was actually surprised that there wasn't any Merrimack and Monitor stuff in this. Like, maybe it just seems... like to within reach that Americans could have made those things at the time. But that seemed like there's some prime technological stuff that ancient aliens might have been involved in.
I mean, surely the Hunley was inspired by USOs, right? I mean, no human could have come up with the idea of a submarine from thin air. That's ridiculous.
It's all hard to imagine.
Now we're getting into why is this happening? And of course you have David Childress, another talking head, who essentially establishes, like Blake said, certain civilizations were just watched over and nurtured by aliens, man.
It's possible that extraterrestrials have been visiting America since its foundation and have been, in fact, steering the outcome this whole time. And why might they want to do that? You would want to see society moving in a direction of greater freedom, greater openness, greater acceptance, so that in time this allows them to have a much more warm welcome than they otherwise would have. There is every reason to believe that extraterrestrials are still watching over us and are having a key impact in the events that unfold on Earth today.
Egyptians, Chinese, Sumerians, they were all doing good because of those aliens. So why not in our own era, the United States? Why wouldn't the aliens be interested in us? And, you know, the answer is they want to get us out of this horrible conflict, make sure democracy lasts to, you know, spread throughout the universe or whatever. We don't know why.
Please let them come back.
I mean, this is the time. This is the time. You know, what Civil War story is complete without Abraham Lincoln? Abraham Lincoln is a great figure, both historically and mythologically. I mean, there's so much that's been said about his flirtation with spiritualism, mostly through his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln. But I mean, I remember when I was a little conspiracy-oriented kid, hearing all of these tales of Lincoln predicting his own death and the connections between Lincoln and JFK and, you know, all of this cosmic stuff, most of which was, you know, more magical than aliens. So I appreciated that in this case, you know, the spirits that are talking to him, again, are not paranormal. They're not from the beyond the veil. They're just, you know, beyond the atmosphere.
I could totally see how you could sort of, from a sci-fi perspective, imagine aliens are watching our planet. For some reason, they decide to care what happens in the conflicts between these species between one species fighting itself. But I'm imagining that they also visit other planets and that there's life out there, whatever. But what I can't figure out is how are they getting into his dreams? Like, what is their alien technology that allows them to do dream manipulation? That's a surprising leap even for aliens to me.
Telepathy, a kind of telepathy.
Yeah, so that was what I, like, when I was watching this, that was what I was thinking. I was like, they're taking, like, this mid-19th century spiritualism and sort of belief in ghosts and things like that, and then just sort of turning that into aliens without having any kind of explanation as to why.
Yeah.
Right? And it just feels like you can get any kind of weird paranormal thing at any time and be like, well, it wasn't actually ghosts, it was aliens. You know, that wasn't a dream. That was an alien communicating with them telepathically through their dreams. That wasn't George Washington. That was an alien pretending to be George Washington because, of course, yes.
Or pretending to be an angel. That was that, you know, it's like it was an alien pretending to be an angel. It's a little confusing. But the same thing happens, I think, you know, in if you don't mind me plugging Monster Talk, we talk a lot about how that there's this idea that you're looking for an explanation, some sort of a source of agency for the weird things that happen. And in some cultures, it's ghosts. In some cultures, it's demons. In some cultures, it's jinn. And it's like you look at the phenomena and it'll be the same things being described, but they attribute it to a different cause. But none of those causes are failures of human perception. They're always some intelligent agency out there. And I think it's a very natural inclination. But boy, these guys are, I think, really pushing the limits of what you can attribute to aliens. Even for a guy who's willing to admit there could be aliens, it seems such a giant stretch to imagine that they, not only have they figured out how to get to Earth and understand our politics and language, but also they can navigate our dreams and manipulate them. And that seems really unlikely to me, but you know, the video says otherwise.
Well, I think that's why, you know, you have to look at the way they structure the argument in all these episodes. And sometimes, I mean, I think that mostly the default is, wow, pyramids are amazing. I can't imagine how anybody would build them today. How did they do it back then? So there is that sense of awe over a thing that's built that you can point to and say, it seems like they shouldn't have been able to do this, but they were. Okay, so obviously some future intelligence.
I'm going to say so. I don't think I've ever said this before, but the show reminds me of conversations I used to have in high school. With my friends, we would all read comic books and watch a lot of sci-fi and horror. And wouldn't it be cool if Freddy fought Jason, you know? Or like, wouldn't it be cool? So it's like the whole thing. If you replace, is it possible? And could it be? But wouldn't it be cool if, like, I'd like this show 100 times more, and I would. Wouldn't it be cool if it was aliens? Yeah, it would.
Right,
it really would. And that's not as much of a stretch as believing it's real. It's just, yeah, that'd be really cool.
Ancient alien theorists say yes, it would be cool. Yeah. That's exactly it. But, you know, in this case, they had to build their argument out by sort of obliquely saying, you know, people were seeing things that were predictive. And then that's why they had all those examples of people seeing things in the sky in advance of the war to say, see, that's the groundwork we're laying for our argument that aliens are somehow involved. Because then after that, there's no stuff in the sky that they're talking about. It's all people getting visited by spirits and whatnot. And, you know, the heart of the show is really, I mean, the heart of this episode really is about Lincoln and his relationship to these predictions and then the argument that they make that, you know, the war might have turned out very differently if he hadn't been visited by these beings who sort of guided his hand through, you know, spiritualists and so on. So you have to sort of have a reckoning with the fact that they're totally recontextualizing spiritualism to be not this fraud pseudoscience that was really popular in the 1800s with apparently everybody. Just everybody was gaga about spiritualism. But if you view that as, no, that was just like the aliens, you know, medium of choice for connecting with people back then, as opposed to now, it's, you know, sucking them up into UFOs and probing them. That was just the way they did it back then. That was their, you know, it's like trends, it's like fads, any number of things. That was their fad. That was how they did it. So, Blake, all this talk about spiritualism gets me wondering about your past and possibly your future. Can we dim the lights a little bit and light some candles and talk about who you are and what you do and a little bit more about Monster Talk?
When did I first realize I was really into this stuff? No, I'm a lifelong enthusiast for all things weird. If you wanted a quick bio, I grew up in a very religiously conservative fundamentalist type family. So we literally believed everything in the Bible was real, which meant that every weird thing in the world might be real, you know, and obviously that there's giant spiritual wars going on and that sort of thing. So when I got into really just the first grade and like got access to the school library, I was an avid reader, and I just immediately fell in love with that whole 100 section with Bigfoot and ghosts. And, you know, my parents really didn't mind what I read as long as, you know, I was reading. So they were, you know, excited about it. But boy, I would scare the crap out of myself with this stuff. And later in life, I think in the 1990s, I started to get really serious about, are these things real? Like, that's really an important question. Like, I loved reading them for the thrills, but I really wanted to know what's at the bottom of them. And so I think it was with the death of the Heaven's Gate cult that really kind of was a gut punch for me, because when I read the bios on those people who had died, it's like they were computer programmers. They were engineers. They were Star Trek fans. And I thought, well, wait a minute. They're into the same stuff as me, but I'm alive and didn't fall into a cult, and they did. Why? Like, what's the difference? Like, why were they so susceptible to these ideas as being literally real rather than just entertainment? You know, it made me just sort of like really start to realize that while I think it's fun to look into this stuff, there may be more dangerous or serious aspects to it. So I started doing a lot of deep investigations, and I found that, you know, most of the times there were really plausible reasons why these things weren't real, but they were interesting and fun to learn about. And I think I did that for about a decade before I learned about other people like me. Like, I didn't know about the skeptical movement, really. I was aware that there were skeptic magazines, but I didn't really read them. And so I ran into, I think it was Michael Shermer on a show talking about sleep paralysis. And I had had a very, very compelling, haunting episode where I thought I was being haunted, and it involved waking up feeling like something was holding me down and being scared. And it turned out that this phenomenon of sleep paralysis is when your body, you go to sleep, you're paralyzed, so you don't act out your dreams, right? And if you wake up and that's still going on, you want to move, but you're incapable of it. And I was having that not regularly, but enough that it was terrifying. And I really thought it was a ghost. Anyway, I hear about sleep paralysis and suddenly I'm like, whoa, wait, hey, there's an explanation for this. I'm not crazy. It really happened, but there's a natural scientific explanation. And that really kind of got me diving in more deeply into those sorts of mysteries beyond just the UFO stuff, getting into ghosts. And of course, I just tried to apply this to everything. And I think it was 2008, I ran into Karen Stolzno at Dragon Con. And we sat down and started talking, and she was up, you know, she was in California at the time, doesn't really matter, but she was here for the skeptical side of things. And we both knew the same monsters. We turned out to have a lot in common, and it made great sense to kind of do the inverse of, remember that show, A Monster Quest? It was a live action adventure show where they went looking for Bigfoot every week or some variant, and they're always looking for different monsters. But every week it would be like 95% mm-hmm. nonsense and like 5% they'd have some skeptic on saying, yeah, but that's not how nature works. You know, that's not how DNA works. And I was like, wouldn't it be cool to have a show that can celebrate the monstrous, but have it be 95% science instead, do the inverse of that. And that's kind of the formula we started with. And, you know, we're still doing it after 15 years, and it's we're still finding new stuff to talk about. I mean, it's we've gotten way beyond the is it real, is it not, because I think there's bigger questions to ask. You know, why are we so culturally attracted to monsters? Why do people have such perception problems yet feel so confident that they, you know, they have a perfect recollection of what happened? So, and I don't, figuring out what it all means is a question they'll never have an answer, because it's going to change depending on where you are in your life. But I enjoy the quest. So,
and what's your relationship to ancient aliens? I mean, obviously you must have crossed paths with it at least obliquely as this kind of monster that's out there.
You know, it's a fun idea. I just think it's possible to take a fun idea too far. And then if you want to keep taking it further, you can get a show like Ancient Aliens, where it's clearly gone way beyond where it should have. And they're out there, man. They're really out there. Not the aliens, but the writers for the show.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think that's what's uncomfortable about it. You know, on the one hand, it's fun and interesting. But, you know, the thing that brought Toby and I back to talking about it was, you know, there's a point at which you have to consciously choose to misrepresent things or present only part of it, or, you know, as in the case of some of the stuff we'll talk about, like completely obliterate certain details that put it into a necessary context. So you understand, like, oh, no, this is really what it is.
It's the disingenuous, right? At what point does it become fraud? Yeah. And I think this episode has a lot of fraud in it.
Oh, yes.
Like for editorial fraud, right? So, I mean, it's hard to say. Like, there's a brain scientist who shows up at one point in this episode. She says, like, two sentences. They did not take her and spend all that effort to record her and only record two sentences. She said a bunch of stuff that was probably very interesting but didn't fit the narrative they were trying to build. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of magic happens in the editorial booth.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't really. I just think it's like you said, like taking people who are actual. Like, I don't. So that was another weird thing about this episode, right? You get some people who are like at least put forward as historians, and they have comments that don't really involve aliens. They're just kind of moving the story along a little bit, and then bam, you get hit with the aliens. And I assume these guys knew that they were going on the Ancient Aliens show.
By this season, you have to know, right?
Yeah. But it just kind of seemed like they didn't. I mean, maybe they buy into it, maybe they don't. But there's nothing that they said that sort of, to me, made them feel like, okay, they're like another ancient astronaut theorist who happens to be a Civil War expert. They just seemed like Civil War people who said a few things, so it sounded like there was an expert rather than just having the voice of God like narrating some more.
What are your bona fides to get on this show? You're either some legitimate academic who's going to be really sad when you see how this comes out, or you're some theorist and they have to invent a description for you, like investigative mythologist. Really?
Yep.
Yeah. I made a note about that too.
You also have to consider that, I mean, and this is what's really sort of troubling, but not unreasonable. You know, it's History Channel, right? So maybe History Channel reaches out to this esteemed Civil War scholar or neuroscientist or whatever, and is like, we're doing a show on the Civil War, you know, and they don't necessarily need to tell you what the show is. They're just like, we're doing a little documentary on the Civil War. And the next thing you know, It's like, well, I did it for the History Channel. Next thing you know, it's like, wait, my interview got folded into something about how, you know, General McClellan was visited by an angelic alien. What? You know.
According to the account, General George B. McClellan, chief of the Union armies, was visited in his sleep by the ghostly figure of George Washington, who warned him that Confederate forces were closing in on the Capitol. The vision reportedly caused McClellan to change his plans and fend off the attack.
I have to assume they have to be somewhat deceptive, or these people are very naive to appear on here. If you're not actually in favor of the ancient alien hypothesis, yeah. And that is a very broad hypothesis, which apparently means anything that happens that's unusual was aliens. That seems to be the blanket.
It definitely,
sort of
approach. Definitely stings.
If you don't buy into that, I don't know why you would be on this show, like at this point.
But if you have been on Ancient Aliens and you want to talk about it, we would love to hear from you. Please reach out. No, I think what is also interesting about this episode is, you know, at the heart of it is this whole sequence with spiritualists, right? Who are these people who have a whole story they're telling about, you know, the veil between the real world and the supernatural world. And they're sort of doing the same thing that the producers of Ancient Aliens are doing, which is like, we're presenting this view of the world beyond the world that you know. And, you know, and it's so much of it is, Blake, like you said, so much of it is just fraud. One of the centerpiece stories is this one in which you have a spiritualist named Nettie Colburn Maynard, who was a real person, who in the episode is presented as someone who was talking to Mary Todd Lincoln, was invited into the White House, who may have met Lincoln herself, and who possibly sort of in a trance gave him the thumbs up on the Emancipation Proclamation, or according to another person, may have even sort of dictated the Emancipation Proclamation to him. But then, of course, you dig in a little bit about Maynard, and it turns out like she did exist. She was visiting Mary Todd Lincoln after the Lincolns had lost their son, Willie, who was a much beloved son. They lost him. He was 11. And incidentally, is the focus of the book by George Saunders, Lincoln and the Bardo, which is a great book. But yeah, Mary Todd Lincoln, very depressed as a result of this death, and was talking to all these spiritualists who, contrary to her Presbyterian upbringing, which said, you know, when someone dies, they're in paradise and essentially unreachable, you have these people who now say, no, they're still around us, and I can show you how to get to them. You can still visit with your dead kid. It's fine. So obviously there's something that lures her in there. And, you know, supposedly she goes into a trance, and maybe or maybe not, Lincoln is even ever in the room. We're never really clear on whether she met him. But I like that Arthur Conan Doyle, who, you know, is the Sherlock Holmes guy, who is also a crazy spiritualist, said of this encounter, this hypothetical encounter with Maynard and Lincoln about the Emancipation Proclamation, it, quote, may have been one of the most important moments in the history of the United States, in which, you know, as the producers tell us, it was an alien speaking through the spiritualist, inspiring Lincoln to ratify the Emancipation Proclamation, outlaw slavery.
And another mystic, J.B. Conklin, claimed these voices actually dictated to the president a first draft of the historic document.
So, Blake, they were against slavery. They just needed to get to it in the most roundabout way possible.
They had to find the floppiest, milk-toastiest way to do it. It's like, we'll cancel slavery in the states we don't control right now. But as soon as we get control, liberation. So, yeah, this is pretty lame. I'm glad it happened. I'm really against slavery. I'm against slavery. Firmly and strongly, and I'm also against Nazism. So I just want to get those, you know, talking points.
I want
out.
You to save that. We've got episodes on Nazis in the future. We got to invite you back.
I'm willing to like put my name on a very strongly worded statement that Hitler was a bad man.
Okay,
not a fan.
Yeah,
I don't want to get all political on you. Sorry,
we're no orifices and no politics in this, podcast.
That's right.
Before we move on from spiritualism, I'd just like to let you both know that even in the 1800s, people were wise to the fact that spiritualism was a bit of a con, so much so that there was a law against the kind of sleight of hand that was involved in, you know, the spiritualist practice, knocking on tables or whatever. The crime was called jugglery or jugglery, something like juggling. But jugglery was a crime in the 1800s, and you could go to jail for being a juggler. So, you know, some laws maybe should come back. Make America great again.
Yeah, they had like the anti-witchcraft laws in New York, and anti-fortune telling, and it's not so much that they don't want people using psychic powers; it's they don't want people getting ripped off. So, I think the thing is, there's this whole idea that when you see a, I'm air quoting, documentary on the History Channel, that what you're seeing is a sincere effort by researchers to present you with the latest discoveries. I ran into this with, I have very serious friends who I love my friends. They're great. We've been friends since college, but who legitimately thought that the ghost hunter shows on TV were serious scientific investigations. If you can't figure out that plumbers are not actually good people to be doing scientific investigations of hauntings, and I'm not basing that on the fact that they're plumbers. I mean, we all need plumbing, but they're not trained scientists. They're trained plumbers. Those TV shows are about, at some level, those TV shows are about the producers making fun of the weird people who were having these experiences. There are people who watch these shows ironically, you know, but there's lots of people who watch these shows with a lot of sincere belief. And while you may create a show thinking you're making fun entertainment that will sell soap, you're also influencing your culture that you live in. And if people don't have the sort of discernment to be able to figure out what's real and what's not real and have the basic epistemology of, you know, evidence-based thinking, then this stuff is really confusing and mysterious and wow, wouldn't it be cool if, and so on. And I don't think that's a really good basis for engaging with the real world. So, as a guy who loves this stuff as entertainment, but who thinks that it turns out if you undermine people's basic ability to discern reality from fiction, it might have broader consequences.
Well, we'll put a pin on that.
You think?
I don't know if that's George Washington's ghost, which is really an alien, leads this army, and they encounter Robert E. Lee. There's a great victory, and, you know, presumably the tide of the war shifted is sort of how they hand wave the way through the rest of this. It's like, see, here's another example of a ghost, and that allows them to neatly pivot into kind of the last act of this, which is to say, yeah, we've been talking about how it's all Civil War era people who are being visited by these ghostly aliens, but really, what if it's been like this the whole time? So we go back to the founding fathers, and they throw out some examples of different founding fathers having experiences that, if you don't look too closely, can seem like they saw aliens or just like they had headache. Jefferson gave an account of somebody seeing something. Franklin wrote about the possibility for life on other worlds. And then they returned to Washington's vision at Valley Forge, thus asking the question, have aliens been intervening since the beginning of these United States?
David Childress, he says here,
we do have clues that Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and George Washington all believed in extraterrestrial life. Thomas Jefferson gave a famous lecture about the unusual UFO sighting by a person named William Dunbarton in Baton Rouge in 1800.
He just basically lists some random things and then says, and so it would seem that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin were very much believers in extraterrestrials and life on other. Like, none of this stuff supported what he said, but he just ends. And so you can see, because he's wearing a hat, therefore he believes in aliens. I mean, it really made no sense. It was so weak. Like, even I, in my somewhat inebriated state as I watched this, whipped myself to attention and said, that doesn't seem like that was a real argument. Yeah.
Is pretty specious. People see things or they think things. Sometimes it's as much as that.
Yeah, people have said things and they believe in aliens, right?
Right. Exactly.
There's often something Toby and I have returned to again and again on this, which is, you know, the metaphor failure syndrome, where something that's clearly intended as an analogy, simile, you know, some figurative language. It's like, well, if you take that literally, then there really was a thing in the sky that was flying and there were wheels and, you know, all that stuff. It's very selective use of how language is supposed to be perceived, how literally it's supposed to be perceived.
I mean, it's practically the basis of the whole show.
I mean, a bad analogy is like a cup of turnips.
Nice.
That rather reminds me of the great American writer Ambrose Bierce, who...
Yes.
Who, rounding third on this episode, he becomes a hero. Now, I will say, and Toby and I have talked about this, one of the accidental things that happens in this show is that, you know, because it's casting so many lines, you do end up getting interested in certain parts of history that maybe you hadn't thought as much about. And in this case, the success of this episode was like, I got to go back and read some Ambrose Bierce. He, you know, interesting.
Never a waste of time.
No,
never
great.
A waste of time.
You know, he's a peer of Poe and he's a peer of Mark Twain and does not nearly have, obviously, the rep, but he was, you know, he was a horror writer, journalist.
His writing is so modern and accessible. It's not florid. It's not. It's. I mean, I love Poe, but Bierce could be written right now, and it would be. You know, it fits in perfectly with our modern language. It's really great. And his Devil's Dictionary is one of the most enviably clever things I've ever read in my life. It is just amazing.
And Toby, would you like to tell us why Ambrose Bierce is so talented?
Pretty sure it might be aliens.
Yeah.
This was actually the most surprising thing in the episode to me because I live in Kennesaw, Georgia. I grew up hiking Kennesaw Mountain and Little Kennesaw Mountain and roaming around there in the daylight and the night. And this is my stomping grounds. And I love Ambrose Bierce. And I never knew that he had walked the same ground as me and been shot in the head right there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was very surprised by it. I'm excited. I actually want to go see if I can find if there's any records of precisely where he was wounded, where the aliens did their magic.
Yeah. Right.
You see, this is what you accidentally learn stuff on this show from time to time.
Yeah. He was shot in the head, may have come up with a new ability, which was to sort of perceive paranormal experiences, disappearances, things like that. He wrote The Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, which is one of my favorites from high school. And I think, again, sort of goes to Blake's point about it feeling very modern. Like you read it and it's not like reading, you know, all these other guys from the mid-1800s that you end up reading. You're like, oh, man, this is like a normal story. But again, it's one of those things. Instead of it being like this cool story, it's like, well, it's his acknowledgement that alternate realities exist. And you know, of course, aliens, which was not my perception as an 11th grader, but again, I was young.
Yeah.
He's a great horror writer. He throws in a lot of twists, but he wrote a lot of fictional things that people seem to believe were true. Mm-hmm. Like The Trouble with Crossing a Field. It's a work of fiction. It's not supposed to be taken literally. And I think when people have trouble distinguishing between what's real and what's fiction, it's not. Oh, wait, didn't we already talk about that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
These are great fictional stories. I don't think he ever presented them as anything but that. And it's shocking to see that that maybe aliens influenced his writing style. And didn't he disappear mysteriously at the end of his own life?
Oh, yeah. That's where the episode takes us, because it's got to have one more sort of sucker punch of mysticism. If you believe that he was in some way communicating with the beyond because he had been shot in the head during a battle in the Civil War, which, by the way, I looked up his, you know, history, and there's a list of all the battles he's in, and he was in like 24 battles. I mean, the guy was in a lot of fights. So good on him that he only got shot in the head once and lived to, so to speak, tell the tale.
The world was richer for his having survived. I think.
Yeah. Like,
oh, for sure. No, he's amazing. Yeah. So in the recent year of 1913, he's heading down to Chihuahua, Mexico, where he disappears. And this is one of the great disappearances in American history for a historical figure. A lot of mystery around it. which obviously you could spend a whole season of television or at least an episode unpacking. They focus on Crystal Skulls, of course, and his encounter with a guy named Frederick Mitchell Hedges, who floated in and out of his life in some way and who claimed to discover the first Crystal Skull. And then in this letter that Bierce wrote to a friend, he said famously, "I go tomorrow to a destination of which I may not return." That was the last letter he wrote to anyone. And then supposedly, according to the show, he went with Hedges to a crystal cave, which was some sort of way to contact these aliens that had been speaking through him for all these years. And so presumably they sucked him up and took him over to wherever, you know, probably to influence the next generation of George Washington's or Joseph Smith's or whatever. They say, well, you know, and you can sort of see them like knocking the dust off their hands and be like, that's it. I'm in Crystal Cave. That's problem solved. And they never mention the fact that there was a little something called the Mexican Revolution going on down in Mexico at that time, and that he was definitely checking out what was going on with Pancho Villa's army. And he had written another letter that said, this is not mentioned in the show, but another letter that said, "If you hear me being stood up against a Mexican stone wall and shot to rags, please know that I think it is a pretty good way to depart this life." So, you know, being a journalist in time of war, as many journalists can tell you now, carries some risks. And it's just as likely that he succumbed to one of those as that he was sucked into space via Crystal Cave. This is my opinion.
Yeah, my friend and colleague, Joe Nickel, his doctoral thesis was about what happened to Bierce. He wrote he put it all together in a book with some of his other research. He calls it Ambrose Bierce is Missing. And spoiler, Joe would never tell you this. He'd say buy the book. But
right.
He put together a pretty good circumstantial case that Bierce, let's keep in mind, was I think 71 at this point, and I think Joe's hypothesis is he was sort of fed up with living and departed on his own terms, I guess is the polite way of saying it. So I would like to say, of all the figures that I've run into in my monster adjacent weird stuff research, Frederick Mitchell Hedges actually sort of stands out as being extra unreliable, like really, really, really unreliable. And then his daughter is even more unreliable. But, you know, like the Crystal Skull, we know it was manufactured. Like we know it was carved using modern tools and it was not found in some pyramid. That's just nonsense. But like his daughter claims that she found it while they were on a dig, I think in the 20s. And his story here, for this to work, it would have been earlier by a good 10 years. So, yeah, if you look into him, he's quite a character. I mean, he did some legitimately crazy stuff, but he also never met a story that he couldn't improve by just making some things up. So, yeah.
Crystal Skull, always a good addition to a story, though. I mean, never makes it worse.
Yeah. Well, how could it? Right. Wait, I seem to remember one of those Indiana Jones movies that somehow it did make it worse.
Which had aliens in it.
That was an endless one. Yeah.
Spoiler. The last segment of the episode takes us to the Capitol. It's the end of the Civil War, almost. Lincoln's still alive, but he approves the Capitol Dome finally being completed. It had been put on hold because of a little thing called the Civil War. And, you know, when you build a dome, you got to put a statue on top of it. So somehow the Ancient Alien producers decided that the statue called the Statue of Freedom is somehow an emblem of our appreciation of the aliens for what they've done for us. Toby, you looked into this statue, didn't you?
I didn't look a whole lot into the statue because I thought it was so, like, on its face stupid that I didn't feel like giving it a whole lot of time because, you know, does that explain the stars on our flag as well? I
mean, it's like national treasure, only there's no treasure.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, it's just, I couldn't really wrap my head around, like, other than the fact that there happened to be stars on it, like, what does it have to do with anything? So, I didn't do a deep dive, but I did, think about it for 30 seconds. It seemed like among a lot of egregious things in this episode, maybe the most egregious in that there just wasn't much there. And if there hadn't happened to be stars, I don't know where you would have gone with it.
Yeah. The idea being if, because this figure had stars on a sort of headband, that connected it to the Native American myth of sky people, who are presumably people from the sky, which the show passes off as, well, those are, of course, aliens, and we're speaking to Native Americans naturally. Right. And stars are a direct connection to people from the stars. So anywhere you see stars, there's got to be aliens. And Toby very unpatriotically dismisses this just because our flag has 50 stars. That's 50 aliens, at least, Toby, if you think about it.
Well, not at the time, though. This is the thing, Brandon.
That's a good point.
At the time, how many states did we have? Somewhere in the 30s?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
That sounds right.
Not a whole lot.
So just kind of like wrapping it up, like narratively, because, you know, if there is a central theme running through this episode, you have to bring it yourself. Mm-hmm. But so George Washington sees an angel that's really an alien. But then later at Gettysburg, a general sees a George Washington that's an angel or an alien? Is an angel as an alien or is a ghost of a angel alien? I got a little confused about exactly. And was it the same alien ghost entity? Yeah. Or like, is it one giant aliens or are there multiple? Because I am, in my reading outside of this TV show, I know that people generally believe there's quite a few alien races with different agendas that they're trying to perpetrate upon us here. And so here it's like one vast aliens, and these are apparently benevolent because they're nudging history to turn out the way it does. Although, golly, a lot of people die.
Yeah.
It seems like maybe that if they really wanted us to whatever be successful is, maybe they could have figured out a way to do it without so many corpses. I don't know.
So I think at the end, I think it's my guy, what's his name? Wilcox.
Mm-hmm.
Wilcox comes on and is basically sort of saying, you know, aliens believe in the same stuff that we do, like equality and, you know, freedom and all this stuff. And that's why they take special interest in us and they're still watching over us. And, you know, we're one of the special nations. And it's, you know, the whole universe is really hoping that everything pans out for us.
Everybody's rooting for America, even out in space.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. America.
So,
yeah, as I say, once we realize the American ideals of the founding fathers, then we will finally come face to face with our alien ancestors. So we got to figure it out. Wow. And then they'll show up.
Let's show up.
Climb out of the crystal caves.
You win.
Blake, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to us.
Yeah, thank you. When does Monster Talk drop? Is it weekly?
So we drop episodes every week on Monday at monstertalk.org, or you could find it by looking for Monster Talk. Squish it together. Don't put a space in between the monster and talk, and you'll find it faster. And then I also do a show called In Research Of, which I mentioned. Go to your podcast app and look for In Research Of. You might search for Jeb Card or myself, Blake Smith, and Monster Talk I co-host with Karen Stolzno, Dr. Karen Stolzno, who I believe will have been on an episode or shall be on an episode. So one of those two things. Anyway, thank you again for inviting me on.
Oh,
that's our show.
All right.
Blake Smith, thank you so
much. Blake, thanks so much. That was really fun.
I really had a good time, guys. I have to run. My children are chomping at the bit to watch One Piece.
All right. See ya.
Thank you, Blake Smith. I am Brandon R. Reynolds.
I'm Toby Ball.
See you next time. More Like Ancient Phalians is produced by Heather Eagle Ears Wilson. And our theme song is by Nathan Reedy.
Next time. Was the whale that swallowed Jonah an alien submarine? Was Muhammad abducted by aliens? And are ancient gods really aliens? We're talking about Strange Abductions, Season 5, Episode 9. See you then.